From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Guardian editor Gary Young reported from the U.S. for over a decade. Today on the show, we talk with him about his book, Another Day in the Death of America.
One of the things that struck me writing this book was every single black parent that I spoke to thought this could happen to their child.
Then a former neo-Nazi reflects on his trip to the Auschwitz concentration camp.
Being there, where it all happened, at the epicenter of a massive atrocity that I once had a hand in denying, was something that I had to do. Something I have to keep doing.
And a Milwaukee writer brews up a what's what and a where's where about the state's best beers.
People support a brewery in their town, no matter how small their town is. People love it. It's their corner pub, but it's more than that. It's a sense of pride.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The mass shooting that killed more than two dozen people at a church in rural Texas over the weekend was the latest in a string of such shootings in this country. From Texas to Las Vegas to Charleston and Newtown, mass shootings shock and outrage Americans for various reasons.
But writer Gary Young says there is another trend that should be just as disturbing, the deaths of children from gun violence every day. Young is black, British, of Barbadian descent, and his wife is African American. He covered the U.S. for more than a decade for the Guardian newspaper, for which he is now editor at large back in Britain.
His recent book is called Another Day in the Death of America. He was in Milwaukee recently to talk about it. And Young says it's the regularity of gun violence that he sees in this country that had always been difficult to explain elsewhere. But it was having two African American children that crystallized the need for him to tell the stories that he does in this book.
I think having two kids in America anyway, if you're not from America, would alert you. You know, the gun that washed up beside my son's school in Chicago, we lived in Chicago for 4 years, or the shootout near his daycare. Those would have happened whatever race we were. Being black just raised the odds. And, I mean, one of the things that struck me writing this book was every single black parent that I spoke to thought this could happen to their child. The mother in Dallas said, I didn't think it would be him, I thought it would be his brother. The father in Newark said, you're not doing your job as a black father if you don't think your child could be shot in Newark. So there is that extra burden because of those extra odds.
The other thing that struck me with this book is the way you decided to explore the topic. You picked a day and you tried to find everyone, every child, who had been shot that day. Why that particular structure?
I was keen by picking a day and then allowing the day to choose the cases and therefore not gaming it. That if I'd picked a different day, I would have a different book. And I was actually particularly insistent, even though in some ways, as a reader, it would be easier if I didn't do this, that the children come in the order in which they're shot, which means the first chapter is in many ways the hardest. It's the youngest child, 9 years old. He answers the door, his mother's ex-partner shoots him in the head, and then runs away and is eventually shot in a shootout with the police. I would not have started with that chapter if I wanted to pace people's emotional kind of engagement with the book, but I was adamant not to game it. And so this is the day, this is how they felt, because to me the power in the conceit is, if this book takes you a week to finish, well, then there'll be pretty much 50 kids will be dead in that week. And this is just the day as I found it. And I took the day at random.
And so those stories are there. It just, whose stories it happens to be that day.
Well, that's it. the next thing about that conceit is really journalistic, that these are happening in plain sight every day. And we are taught, I was taught in journalism school, you know, dog bites man is not a story, man bites dog is a story. And there's a way in which these are dog bites man stories. And that sooner or later you have to ask yourself, who owns these dogs? And why do the same people keep being bitten? And what can we do to stop this happening? There is something about the way that these deaths happen here and the way in which the country has become inured to them, well, that just happens. And so long as they happen in a certain way, in certain places, to certain people, then it becomes the kind of white noise that everybody can be used to. Every now and then the country is kind of concretized by a mass shooting, but these do not make the headlines. And so that was the other journalistic kind of drive in this pursuit, was to tell stories that aren't told.
The media, as you say, in the country doesn't report these deaths. They happen so often. There might be one or two lines in a newspaper. What role does American journalism play in continuing this cycle?
Well, to be fair, you know, journalism can't be understood outside of the context of society. So there are things that are going on in Britain that are, you know, I wouldn't even know what they are because I'm British. It would take an, you know, it was, if you wanted to know what was going on in Ireland, you didn't read a British newspaper in the 60s. You would have read the Boston Globe or the New York Times or whatever they were, you know. There was some good reporting from Britain, but by and large, outsiders just will see things that you don't see. And it doesn't mean they're always right. It's not really about being right. It's just having a sort of different gaze. And so it's not just journalism. I think American society doesn't see these deaths. They are mostly poor. They are disproportionately black and brown. So they don't see these people, they don't see these lives, so why would they see these deaths? You know, when Katrina happened, and then suddenly all of these poverty and this, it was washed up, and people were kind of like, well, you know, where the hell did that come from? Or Black Lives Matter, that it's not that more people are being killed by the police, it's that we are now paying attention to something that's been going on for a while. And so it speaks to a broader problem of race and class. Now, these are problems that every society has. It's just that the one thing that no other Western society has is guns on this scale.
When you were doing the research to learn about the lives of these children who were killed, were people talking to you about Second Amendment? Because that comes up so much here. Whether you are pro-gun or anti-gun or whatever it is in this, and there are a lot of people in this country who are very anti-gun and would like to see the kinds of restraints on them that you have in Britain, that you have in Canada, that you have in Australia. Mm. So were people talking about it in those ways?
It was one of the oddest things to me. It never came up. The Second Amendment never came up. Actually, guns barely came up. I would ask each family the open-ended question. 10 kids died that day, were shot dead that day, and I would speak to, I reached 8 kin, and I would ask them, well, what do you think this is about? Not a single one mentions guns. And I assume that it's a bit like traffic, that if your child was run over, you wouldn't think, well, we must get rid of traffic because it's difficult to imagine a world without traffic and it's not going anywhere, so why waste your emotional energy on something that's not going to happen? So it doesn't come up. When I ask a more leading question, what do you think of guns, then people generally would say, well, I think it's crazy, you know, there's too many of them around, it's too easy. They would evoke the ancient art of pugilism, you know, in my day we would settle them with our fists and so on. But with the open-ended question, no, it doesn't come up. I get that, actually. I do get that. And particularly with the Second Amendment, when I was promoting the book last year, quite often the Second Amendment would come up in radio call-ins. And I would emphasize, look, this is not a book about gun control. It's just a book that is made possible by the lack of gun control. So I'm not going to argue with you about scripture, which is essentially what the Second Amendment is. You just have to talk to me about how we keep these kids alive and how I keep my kids alive in a country where 7 children are shot dead every day. Or do you love that amendment more than you love your kids?
And what would they say?
A range of things, few of which to me were plausible. Well, there were arguments which I disagree with, but I think, you know, I can engage with, you know, it's about parenting, it's not about guns, it's you know, lack of morality and all. And to that I would always say, I don't think that American parents are worse than parents anywhere else in the Western world. I don't think American kids are worse than anywhere else in the Western world, so it's got to be something else. One gentleman said, well, look, if you took a few cities out of the country, then this number goes way down. And I said, well, If you took Chicago and New Orleans and Newark, and if you took those out of the country, but then where are you going to get your jazz from? Where are you going to get your blues from? Where, you know, where are you going to get a range of things that make America what it is? And so people kind of actively try and imagine America without these people and the places that they live. And in a sense, that's the kind of heartbreaking thing, the degree to which people will seek to dismiss these deaths as being the function of some kind of death wish culture, which I just don't think it is. I think Americans like life as much as anybody else anywhere else in the world.
You wrote in here that you felt like you had to scream every day that you were working on this book. Was it worth it?
It was definitely worth it for me. It was the last thing I did. I reported from America for 12 years, and this was the end of this time. I learned a huge amount about the country doing this, and you can get quite jaded, particularly on something like this, where there would be a mass shooting, and I would be called, Gary, there's been a mass shooting, go to Virginia, Aurora, Red Lake, Minnesota, you know, I mean, and you run out of adjectives, you run out of metaphors, and, you know, after a while you're like, what do you want me to do? And so to kind of deep dive in the way that I did, and to struggle with some of the explanations, and to think, well, where's that coming from? What does that mean? What, you know, to kind of terms that I have used often, like gang related, and then to kind of see the lives of these kids and think, well, that's not actually telling you very much. If you grew up in that block or that project, whatever, then everybody in that project is gang related. I mean, just by fact that you live there, and it's no more meaningful than saying, well, he was a communist, and because, you know, if they live in China, when you're surrounded in the way that you are, in a gang-controlled area, then you have a relationship to that gang, even if that relationship is that you're not in it. I discovered that black fathers are more likely to bathe their children, change their children, read to them, put them to bed, than any other race. A father. And I thought, well, that can't be true, because I thought I knew. And then you think, well, hang on, you do those things. You know, and I married an American, as I said, I have American kids. I thought I knew the country, and in a range of ways this book showed me how much more there was to know, and how some of the things I knew were far more interesting than I ever realized.
Do you feel like you have come to different conclusions?
I have a bit. I mean, I do think that my relationship to the gun control issue has become more complicated insofar as anything that they could do to reduce the number of guns in the society would be a good thing, I believe. If guns, more guns make you safer, then America should be the safest place on earth, and it's not. But I did, by the end, think it's more than that, that America needs a different story for itself that isn't about conquering and domination and masculinity and homestead and small government and rugged individualism, because all of those lead to the gun. And America's not alone in having those. Britain is in the process, thanks to Brexit, of finding out how small it is as a country. It's a long time coming, and it's an unfortunate way to find out. But that being small, but having an empire, and then being in the European Union and having a special relationship with America and all of those things have given Britons a kind of different sense of who they are, somewhat puffed up. Well, now we are finding out how small we are. Every country has its own myths, and some of those myths are deadly, and this is one of them, I think. So it changed my thinking about that, and it gave me some sense, therefore, of why, whatever the next one will be, why nothing will happen, because those myths will endure long after the pictures of the grieving people have gone. The other thing I would say, this is less, you know, pleasant, was the degree to which people really, in order to dismiss these deaths, or in the process of dismissing these deaths, actually strip the dead of their humanity. When I started, I thought, well, obviously segregation is a barrier to empathy. You know, well, I don't know those people, so kind of there's less reason why I should care. That's normal. But by the end of it, I thought that some people thought this wasn't just happening to people unlike them, but it was actually not happening to people at all, but to a different kind of species. And that species was one where parents didn't love their children and children didn't love life, and where parents were negligent and children were feral. And so everybody was working on a different kind of premise in which the value of life was diminished, which is just simply not true. I mean, my experience of meeting the families and talking to them, it's not true. They knew their kids, they loved their kids, they wanted their kids to live, and one of the things that hurts is the notion that their child was removed from the planet, and it didn't seem to challenge anything about how America thinks about itself. If anything, it just confirmed it.
Nothing changed, including attitudes.
Right. Nothing changed, and kind of worse than that, in a sense, when people heard, oh yes, in Pleasant Grove, Dallas, or in this, they thought, well, that's what happens down there. So it actually confirms what they thought. In 2002, I interviewed Maya Angelou, and she, referring to 9/11, she said, well, everybody was shocked, everybody was stunned, but African Americans have been living in a state of terror in this country for several hundred years. And so the idea that something like this might happen, not this in particular, but something so, is not so counter to, you know, what we've experienced. And I thought it was interesting, and I put it in my piece, but I didn't really understand it until I'd written this book and realized and empathized as a parent with the idea that these parents are walking around not worrying, will my kid go to college? I hope he or she meets someone nice. You know, what will they wear to graduation? But will my child stay alive? Will my child stay alive?
Do you have any hope that it will change? I mean, like you say, you have American kids. Your wife is American. I assume even though you're back in Britain, you'll be visiting family and that sort of thing. I mean, do you hope things change? And if so, how do you see it changing?
I don't see the roadmap particularly. I say in Britain when, because nobody else gets this. So, you know, the book's been translated into French and Dutch. And so I've done events elsewhere and people say, well, do you think they can change? And I say, look, with my tongue half in my cheek, they elected Barack Obama, and then they elected Donald Trump. And that means they can do anything that they put their mind to. For a country that has done so many things, one must believe that they could do this. So, yeah, I think it's possible.
Do you think it's probable?
No, I don't. But an awful lot can change in a place in a quite quick period of time. Americans aren't any dafter than anyone else in the world. If everybody else can get it, Americans can get it. The question is, what will it take? And the reason why I don't think it's probable is if Sandy Hook didn't do it, then one wonders what event, you know, will do it. And also, if we look at, I don't know, what's going on with Harvey Weinstein and all of the stuff, that suddenly things unravel. And things unravel at such a pace and in such a way that kind of within months, one can move what should have taken years, can move in months.
So we can hope.
There's always hope.
Well, Gary Young, it has been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gary Young is the editor-at-large for Britain's The Guardian, and he is author of Another Day in the Death of America, a chronicle of 10 short lives. He was in Milwaukee last month to speak at Cardinal Stritch University, and we spoke with him then.
Coming up next, a one-time neo-Nazi shares the story of his trip to the Auschwitz concentration camp. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today and tomorrow mark the 79th anniversary of Kristallnacht, the time when the Nazi campaign to eradicate Jews in Germany became explicit and violence against them commonplace.
Organizations which track hate crimes have noted with alarm that anti-Semitic incidents in the United States have been on the rise since the elections a year ago. That concerns essayist Arno Michaelis. Michaelis is a former neo-Nazi and a white supremacist from Milwaukee who now leads the anti-hate group Serve to Unite. Michaelis wrote about visiting the Auschwitz concentration camp, and he shared his essay with us.
I didn't want to go. Who wants to go somewhere where a million people were murdered? The men, women, and children who were systematically tortured and executed certainly didn't want to go. Just like me, I imagine they would have much preferred to go to the movies, or to work, or to the dentist. Anywhere else than the place called Auschwitz. But they didn't have a choice. I did. So how the hell did a beaming smile find itself on my face as I barely made the train to Auschwitz? That's the sleepy town where the death camp once operated. The exhilaration of exploration had a lot to do with it. Wandering the beautiful city of Krakow, thousands of miles from home, without speaking a lick of Polish, and without the social seatbelt of cellular coverage, delivers a high that none of the drugs I've done, which is most of them known to man, at least at the turn of the 21st century, could ever come close to. Literally using the force to know which stop to jump off the Cold War-era tram packed with Poles of all ages and walks of life, and to know which way the train station was as the conductor wetted his lips to sound the departure whistle. That kind of journey will produce a smile like no other. But the most essential ingredient in my cherished stranger in a strange land smile is always people. The cab driver who brought me from KRK to Krakow. My man could eke out a bit more English than I could Polish, which again is zero. Fast 89 zlotys, slow 69 zlotys. You choose. I chose slow, and we commenced the 25-minute scenic route. Agog over the quaint houses and shops and towns I'd never seen, my little kid Buzz was soured by the repeating pattern of anti-Semitic graffiti. The Star of David with a line through it, over and over again along a 4-kilometer stretch. Perhaps for the sake of gang prevention intervention guys like myself, who could interpret such symbolism in a Chicago street gang context, no Jews accompanied some of the defacements. I wanted to ask my new friend about it, but was intimidated by the language barrier. Earlier, I was asking how to say the street name where my apartment was. I gave up after four attempts. He followed up with, "Street name Polish Fighter." "Ah, like from the war?" He smiled and made Fred Sanford-esque boxing motions. "Oh, like a boxer?" He frowned a bit and shook his head before chuckling, "My English no good." Thus I ruled out a proper conversation on the intricacies of contemporary anti-Semitism in Poland. Instead, I opted to address another important issue, my low blood sugar and elevated risk of migraine. Digging a bag of almonds out of my backpack, I felt obliged to offer homie some before I dug in. "Would you like some almonds? They're organic." His puzzled mug met mine in the rearview mirror as I shook the bag in his direction. I was contemplating whether telling him they were from the Whole Foods on Prospect Avenue in Milwaukee would sweeten the deal, but instead giggled out, "No?" "Yes, yes!" And he probed a finger to coax almonds into his hand, elaborating wordlessly with a grin and a wink what kind of fool wouldn't want some crunchy, delicious organic almonds from the Whole Foods on Prospect Avenue in Milwaukee. We both laughed as I shook more almonds into his cupped hand at the next stoplight. The cab dropped me off and I set out to explore Krakow. Wandering the town square, I found a fake beer I really liked, and I found myself really appreciating all of the people that I met. The server who smiled with patient amusement after saying the name of the fake beer for the fifth time and me mimicking horribly. It was something like Zivnich Nisko Alkohovia. The teenage girl with the Final Fantasy silver purplish hair running the concessions at the Ars Cinema, a brilliant movie theater remodeled from an ancient mansion. "Do I buy tickets here too? Can I get extra butter on the popcorn? Do you have non-alcoholic beer?" Every one of my questions was answered with the most endearing giggle, like I was the most amusing dumb American she had ever seen. But not at all in a mean way. She giggled as if I were a silly puppy. The rough-looking teenage boys on the tram, who pointed out the ticket machine after seeing me dog paddle through a dense river of humanity, trying to drop a 5-zloty coin into anything metal with a remotely coin-shaped orifice. I asked each of them how to say thank you in Polish, multiple times. Each very pleasantly and patiently replied, "Dziękuję," multiple times. It sounded kind of like "Dziękuję," I think. I've been able to get it after it was said to me a bunch of times. Then I'd repeat it as I walked down the street. "Dziękuję, dziękuję, dziękuję." Cracking up at the thought of how I must look. Saying "dziękuję" to myself and thinking it sounded just like they said it, up until I had an occasion to thank someone, at which point I'd blather out something to the effect of "nostrobria." Brilliant, huh? It gets better. Also, because I'm a gifted genius, I found myself answering any question where a yes would be appropriate with "C," further emphasizing my inability to speak Polish with my inability to speak Spanish. All of that had everything to do with the smile I wore, despite feeling like maybe I shouldn't be smiling. "Dziękuję." Almost there now. Still smiling as foreboding woods trot by outside the train window. Woods where I have a feeling nightmares happened, along the way to one of the worst nightmares in human history. I'm still smiling because I know what an honor it is to have this chance to bear witness, to breathe in the suffering of millions of my human family, the suffering that still drives people to hurt each other today, the suffering that hurts so bad it can take the human right out of any one of us the moment we pass our hurt on to others instead of cradling ourselves with loving kindness. Smiles help to conjure up that loving kindness when it's most needed, even in the face of Adolf Hitler. Hitler himself wasn't the problem, really. The cause of the Holocaust was the society that allowed him to come to power. A society reigned by fear. Fear of people who seemed different. Fear of not having enough. Fear of standing up. Fear of speaking out. Most of all, most simply, fear of change. "Dziękuję, dziękuję." I'm back on the train now. My trip to Auschwitz included a return ticket. As the train begins to move, I don't know if I'm glad to leave or not. I saw a room full of shoes, piles and piles of shoes. Shoes that once belonged to men, women, and children. Shoes carefully chosen before the feet that went in them were displaced from homes along with the rest of their bodies. Little kid shoes that once caught a parent's eye from a shop window, thinking, "These will look so cute on my little one." Before the room full of shoes, there was a room full of eyeglasses. My dad noticed I needed glasses when I was 8 years old and unable to read letters on a sailboat not too far from his buddy's Chris Craft while we awaited 4th of July fireworks on Lake Michigan. Our prescriptions were almost identical. Lifetimes of sight and experience cut brutally short, lying in an imposing spidery mound. Then there was a room full of pots and pans. My mom has a favorite pot that she's had since college. It's perfect for making popcorn. That pot produced the popcorn that, along with ice cream, composed crap dinner she used to make us when she was too tired to cook a proper meal. A room full of pots, each filled with dinner stories of their own. Another room was full of Jewish prayer shawls that I'll never really understand the importance of, other than the truth that these bits of blue and white cloth literally meant the world to the men they were torn from. Their woven connection with God. Next, a room full of human hair. Some removed from gas chamber corpses and some removed from live people by the forced labor of fellow Jews before they were executed with mechanical precision. There's a room full of 4.2 million names, shown to me by a man who won't rest until each of the remaining million-plus names are uncovered. I don't know that I'm glad to leave such horror, because I feel an obligation to honor as much of the immense suffering as I can. Being there, where it all happened, at the epicenter of a massive atrocity that I once had a hand in denying, was something that I had to do, something I have to keep doing. So what the hell was I smiling about? What the hell am I smiling about now? Bumping these words into my phone on a rickety old train with fresh tears following the trail of dry ones down my cheek. I'm smiling because I know it's far and away the best way to cultivate a reality where the Holocaust can't happen again. Yes, there is horror happening somewhere on Earth as I live and breathe. Yes, there are human beings hell-bent on proving themselves unworthy of such a title as I read this. All the more reason for gentleness when it comes to what we put into the system that we all exist in. Happy people are much less susceptible to hate. All of us share the same capacity for shame or greatness, hate or love. All of us are subject to the unbearable pain of a broken heart, no matter what color our skin is, no matter what language we speak, no matter how much money we do or don't have, no matter what spiritual tradition or lack thereof. No matter who we're attracted to or how we relate to gender, all suffering is as deserving of someone to bear witness to it as the Holocaust is. A genuine human smile is one of the most powerful weapons we can wield against the kind of rampant hatred that led our human race on a collision course with Auschwitz. A smile is gratitude. When we express gratitude for things like knowing when to jump off the tram, and people like the girl at the movie theater with the giggles and the silvery purple hair, and experiences like sharing some almonds with a taxi driver, we are tending a garden of inner peace where our interdependence with all life is a welcome given. We are finding immense value in each moment and broadcasting like moments into the universe. When we share that authentic happiness with the world around us, it becomes contagious. As a former neo-Nazi who once espoused the same hatred that destroyed millions, I understand the antidote to that hate, presence and love. Most of all, though, a smile is fearless. When we find the courage to look at all of our great human family with the love and adoration of kinship, and all the more so when we find new differences to celebrate, the idea of hurting anyone becomes anathema. When we can be confident in the basic goodness of existence and smile in appreciation, Ideologies of fear and separatism have no purchase on who we are. A simple smile is proof against the kind of fear that twists society into a hell on earth. Jizkulia, Auschwitz. My heart is awakened like never before and utterly fearless. That makes me smile.
Arno Michaelis is a former white supremacist from Milwaukee who now leads the anti-hate organization Serve to Unite.
We'll take a short break and then return with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
In heaven there is no beer, that's why we drink it here. And when we're gone from here, well, our friends will be drinking all the beer. Everybody,
we're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Wisconsin is known for a lot of things. Cheese, dairy farms, the Packers, the Brewers, and of course, the beer that's brewed here. The state's 150 breweries are located in cities large and small, although over 40 of them are in Milwaukee alone. Whether you talk about Pabst, Leinenkugel's, or Schlitz, the beer that made Milwaukee famous, beer is central to Wisconsin heritage and identity.
Kathy Flanagan is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and for its tapmilwaukee.com. She covers all things beer, an impressive undertaking in a place like Wisconsin. She has parlayed that knowledge into an ambitious book called Beer Lovers Wisconsin, Best Breweries, Brew Pubs, and Beer Bars.
Flanagan joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to discuss what makes a beer or a place that serves beer stand out.
That's a really good question because it's a couple of things. Obviously, it's the quality of the beer, but it's also sort of the feel of the place. There are a few places you can go to and you just know they pay attention to you or it feels comfortable and you can sit there all day. And if they have great beer, you'll go back and back and back again.
So in addition to drinking lots of beer for research for this book, you also traveled all around the state for this. So what surprised you the most about our state in your road trips? You know, it doesn't even necessarily have to be connected to the breweries you visited, but just about Wisconsin culture and how it's tied to it.
You know, I think it was the sense of community around beer. When you get up to up north, we went to Ashland, and South Shore Brewery is a big part of the city there. And they actually moved their production brewery away from the city of Ashland to the neighboring city, Washburn. And it was like 10 to 4 on a Friday afternoon, and there were people waiting outside for the tap room to open. Then you go over to Superior, and it's people and their dogs sat outside, Thirsty Pagan. Almost everywhere we went, there were regulars, and we went at all times of day because we were trying to get, and when I say we, my husband and I, we were trying to get so many breweries in a short amount of time. So I think it was that idea that people support a brewery in their town, no matter how small their town is. I tell the story of Bloomer, Wisconsin, which is a very small town, and the owner brought back some pre-prohibition recipes, and people love it. They like having a brewery in their town. It's their corner pub, but it's more than that. It's a sense of pride. Same is true in Potosi, where the whole town backed bringing back the brewery that had once been the fifth biggest in the nation.
With Wisconsin culture and towns and economics so centered around beer, you know, since its founding and all the major companies, you know, known nationally have been founded here, you state that Wisconsin breweries reflect the state itself. Can you expand upon that a little bit?
Well, Milwaukee is known as Brew City, obviously. We are the Brewers. And I think that we've always had this sort of image as a beer state. For one thing, we make all the lists of corner, you know, most corner bars, most drinkers. I mean, it's very positive and negative effects
yeah.
to it. But I think it's always been a part of our life. And someone explained it to me as when the immigrants first came here and they started working in Milwaukee, they worked 6 days a week. And on the seventh day, that was it. They had beer. And I think that ethic has stayed with us a little bit.
Now, with this book, you list breweries, brew pubs, which is unique to Wisconsin, and beer bars. So could you explain the three of those?
If you have a brewery, you cannot, if it's a production brewery, you cannot serve cocktails or wine at it. If you have a brew pub, you can serve cocktails and wine, but you can only make a certain amount of beer. And the beer bars are just bars that tend to specialize in beer. It's complicated because all the rules involving alcohol in Wisconsin are complicated.
Right.
But it changed. There are some places that can do both. Lakefront, Milwaukee Brewing, Spreckard, we're all grandfathered in. They're allowed to serve cocktails so they can have wedding receptions at their places. But the newer breweries have to decide immediately, are they going to be a brew pub or a production brewery?
You go into a little bit in your book about how Madison was really the first to launch the rise of the craft brewery. But here in Milwaukee, Sprecher was the first craft brewery in Milwaukee since Prohibition, actually. So I'm curious, with craft breweries seeming to pop up, new ones maybe every month or, you know, maybe even more often, what are they trying to accomplish today in an ever-competitive market?
It's true. I mean, there was Sprecher in 82 or 33, and then Lakefront and Lake and Water Street were in 87. And then that was followed by Milwaukee Brewing. And then it was sort of, you know, Brenner came along and a few others came along. But in the last couple of years, last 2 years exactly, it's been crazy. The boom's been crazy. I think some of it is demographics. You know, Milwaukee's not – Madison has the demographics that were perfect for craft beer. Milwaukee is beginning to feel those demographics. I think there's a little bit more appreciation for entrepreneurship here. And I see that some of the people coming back, like Third Space Brewing, the two owners there, the founders, Kevin the brewmaster, worked in California, and Andy Gale was a lawyer in Chicago. They came back here because this is their home. And I see some of that, too. I see some brewers coming back here now that Milwaukee is the right place for craft beer.
Now, there's an interesting duality in Milwaukee where people are coming back to found these craft breweries, but yet we're still the home of Miller and Miller Coors and wide distribution of Miller Lite and other, you know, people can have their own opinions on it, but the Miller Lite and other craft breweries are definitely different scales on the spectrum of
yes,
beer.
Definitely.
So do you think people will always be loyal to both, or just do you think people in Wisconsin and Milwaukee have a sense of supporting new entrepreneurship, but also having Miller Lite in their fridge at home to have at any time?
That's interesting because, you know, I have friends who will only drink Coors Light or, you know, some sort of beer like that. And people like what they like. You don't change their minds. And that's not my job. But I think that they'll always support Miller because it's a big supporter of Milwaukee. They have great brewers there. The people who work there know beer. It's not my, you know, to my taste, I prefer a little more complexity in my beer. But I think that they know beer, and I think people appreciate that. Plus, how do you, I mean, you go to Summerfest, it's Miller. You go to, until recently, you go to Miller Park, it's all Miller or a few other choices. So it's hard not to see the impact.
Now, I imagine it was overwhelming for you to squeeze in so many breweries and to try all of these different drinks. So do you think consumers can be negatively overwhelmed by all the choices coming out today?
Oh, yeah. I think it's really easy to be overwhelmed. I think that actually is a bigger problem for some of the new brewers. And when you're on retail shelves, you're working not only against the people who are in your town, but breweries from other states and other towns, and everybody is looking for space on the shelf. And I think that's where it can be most overwhelming. I think if you're at a beer bar, you go, you buy a flight, you're fine. You could try a lot of different ones in small amounts. But you go to the store and you're just like, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do next. And that's where the fight's going to be. Everybody always asks, is there a bust coming? And I don't know if it's going to be in the number of breweries we have here. I'm sure it will shake out some. But I think the bigger fight's going to be on the retail shelves.
With Milwaukee, this city alone takes up the first big section of your book with the amount of breweries that are here. And what I found pleasantly surprising is that the breweries in the city emphasize the neighborhood feel and community aspect, highlighting, you know, bringing in neighbors or benefiting the community that they're in. So what are some that stand out for you in that respect?
I think of River West, which is a great place to have a brewery. Company Brewing for a long time has been doing a neighborhood hops harvest, and that you bring your hops to them and they make a beer out of it. And the day I went to try it, the waitress said, yeah, it's crazy, but they did it. And they did. It's really good. I think that since Black Husky opened, it fits into the neighborhood really well. It looks like it's always been there, and it's just got a sense of being an anchor to River West. Gathering Place is still finding its place there, but I think it's also it's almost like if you drew a line through River West, it would cross the neighborhood, and that's kind of great. That's a perfect place to have three different breweries. I think the same is true for Fifth Street, where you can walk down Fifth Street and go to Mobcraft, Brenner, and Urban Harvest, which gets neglected because it's a small brewery, but it's really neighborhoody and it feels very comfortable when you walk in there.
Well, and more of these places are encouraging you to come, bring your family, maybe even bring your dogs, bring in your own food. And it's about coming and having an experience versus going to, say, I live in Bayview, going to the neighborhood bar that's the bottom half of a house that only serves alcohol. You know, it's a different feel. And do you think this is encouraging a different kind of beer culture?
Yeah, you're right. I think it is. I mean, I like the idea of a bar in the bottom of a house as much as anyone. But I also like going to Third Space, for instance, where they have bags and kids are welcome, dogs are welcome, especially in summer where everybody's hanging out outside and you go to a food cart and, you know, a food truck. And I mean, I think that is a very family-oriented kind of thing to do. And I know so many people will disagree on that. But I think that we've always sort of been like that. I didn't grow up exactly here, but I went to the bar with my dad sometimes, and I had a Coke, and I saw how people reacted, and that was, again, the word anchor. It was an anchor to our community.
How do breweries hold importance in small towns compared to larger cities? You mentioned a particular brewery in Plymouth and its importance of the town.
Well, Plymouth is pretty small, and I think, if I remember right, they just opened a bigger production facility, but their downtown tap room is just, it's nice. And you can smell popcorn and you go in and it's warm and cozy. It was not even winter when I went, but it was warm and cozy. And I think that they do a lot in the community. They're part of, you know, it's where people go after an event or a parade, or they do some theater there that people go to afterwards and enjoy a Plymouth beer. And that's what it is. It's a center area. It's not all bars are nameless and faceless. There's still those Cheers kind of bars where people know who you are. But I think tap rooms are part of that now, too.
One company in particular in Wisconsin, New Glarus, they are unique in that they only sell in Wisconsin. You can only get it here. So I'm curious, is it worth the trip / the hype? And what does a company gain from only selling in the state? Is it purely marketing or is it something bigger that keeps them going strong?
By volume, they're among the top 25 breweries in the country of craft breweries. So just selling in Wisconsin seems to be working for them. I think it started, and I don't want to speak for Deb Carey, but I know that they were selling in Chicago for a while, and she just didn't want to deal with, you know, the kinds of things they wanted her to do. When they're in Wisconsin, they make sure that the tap lines are clear for all their beers, which they're one of the first to ask people to do that, keep the lines clean and make the beer taste better. So I think that they like that kind of control, which I don't, no problem with that. It does work for them, and they're worth the hype. I would not say that Spotted Cow is my favorite of their beers, but I like their R&D. Those beers, I really like Ufta. I like several of their beers. And when you go out there, the brewery is beautiful. It's just got a great view. People are nice. And it's so super clean.
Well, and it also touches on that hometown pride aspect that I feel Wisconsin companies can really take advantage of.
Oh, yeah. New Glarus has got to be grateful they're there because they share the name, but they bring a lot of people in. I have never gone there and not counted out-of-state plates. You know, we go and it's Illinois, it's Iowa, it's all over. And, you know, they're doing something right if that many people want it, and then to keep people wanting it is a pretty good idea.
Exactly. So with your book, you include a beer lover's pick for some of the places included that are your particular favorites. So to go over some that are here in Milwaukee that our listeners can easily make a trip to, let's start with Black Husky. What's your pick for them?
I love the Spruce. It's my go-to beer there, but pretty much I'll try anything they make. I do love the Spruce. I just got the Sparkly Eyes because they had a big release, and it's good, but I'll go back to the Spruce all the time.
How about Good City Brewing?
I like Reward, their double IPA. It's an award winner. I like it a lot, but I will have Motto in my refrigerator often because it's an easy drinking pale ale, and it tastes really good.
We also have Raised Grain Brewing Company.
Anything there is pretty good, and it's pretty heavy. By heavy, I mean like alcohol heavy. They lightened it up a little bit for their beer gardens in the summer, but they make a Paradox. It won gold at the Great American Beer Festival the year before this, and it's really, really delicious. But their black walnut beer, that's delicious too. And any of their specialty releases, which they do often, their stouts are really, really good.
Let's see. Third Space Brewing Company, the one we talked about a little bit before.
I like all their beers. And they just won a gold at the Great American Beer Festival in Denver for their Unite the Clans Scottish Rye Ale. They do a Java Blanca. So it's a cream ale that tastes like coffee. And they do this with Stone Creek Coffee.
I would even try this.
Your head just kind of like you don't believe you're looking at this sort of yellow blonde beer, and then you get a big hit of coffee, and it's perfectly matched. It's really nice.
With so many beer choices, all of these places and kinds of beer that you've had, what beer is on your mind right now that you're looking forward to having, like tonight or this weekend?
Stouts. This time of year, I start to get into stouts. I like them a lot. And I saved a couple of Central Waters barrel-aged Scotch ales because I really enjoy them. So they're sitting in a tray outside of the refrigerator so I don't drink them too quickly. And then I've also been drinking a little. It's Chocovesa. It's from Stone. I don't like overly sweet beers, but it has cinnamon. It has a little bit of pepper in it. And it a little bit of chocolate. And I think that's on a cold night, that's kind of nice to have and sit before a fire with.
Well, as we both know, beer is not only a summer or spring drink in Wisconsin.
No, it's not. And they're coming out with really fabulous recipes. I mean, Milwaukee Brewing has Louise Resurrection coming up, and it's aged in brandy barrels. And it's a light sipper, but then you realize, oh, yeah, this has been sitting in brandy for a while. Lakefront will bring out its barrel-aged beers Black Friday, and I save those in the basement so I can bring them out for special occasions.
Well, Kathy, Beer Lovers Wisconsin is certainly well done, and I'm sure people will have a lot of new breweries to explore.
Thank you. I hope they do.
Kathy Flanagan is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and author of Beer Lovers Wisconsin. She'll be at Sprecher Brewing this Saturday from noon to 2 to discuss beer and her work.
She'll also kick off Brew City MKE and the Milwaukee County Historical Society's Books and Brew series the evening of November 16th. You'll find out more information about both events at WUWM.com.
That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.
When you're drinking with Chad Rapp, Wisconsin must be on each cap. We don't drink